Welcome back to Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bilt, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. We have another week, another day, another dollar, another set of papers to get into. Before we get started, do not forget to go over to Right on Prime. That's right, Right on Prime. It's CME. It's goody awesomeness. It's MRAP. It's primary care. It's emergency medicine. It's inpatient medicine. It's urgent care medicine. It's all just everything medicine. And it's phenomenal. You get CMEs for it. It's awesome. You should check it out. Now, with that being said, also don't forget to rate this podcast or tell your friend about it. That is two ways that you can help me help you, is that you either tell a friend or you give it a five-star review online, so that way other people can help find the podcast. I promise it'll only take 2 seconds of your time. Now, with that being said, without any further hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Questioning medicine, let's kick it off. Now, if I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. Literally, I think there was maybe a thousand times I said it over the course of three podcasts earlier in Questioning Medicine. But the first paper that we're going to dig into is from the BMJ 2019, titled Primary Cervical Screening with High Risk Human Papillomas Virus Testing, an Observational Study. Now, again, this was an observational study, but they looked at almost 600,000 patients that were undergoing cervical cancer screening. In this study, they did routine cervical cancer screening with high-risk HPV testing with the liquid-based cytology. But then you got a recall if you were high-risk HPV positive and cytology negative. And then they just followed the national screening age intervals for recommendations. Now, again, this is a whole bunch of women, but let me just give you the bottom line. Man, I have not said that in so long, and it feels so good. The bottom line here is that if you were listening to Question Medicine, then you were way ahead of the curve, because routine primary high-risk HPV screening increased the detection of CIN grade 3 or worse and cervical cancer by approximately 40 and 30% respectively, compared with liquid-based cytology. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, high-risk HPV is certainly better than liquid-based cytology. There is no doubt. I don't think at this point we can say, oh, well, it's better than co-testing, though. It's got to be better than co-testing. No, we can't say that one yet, but we can say that if the majority of the benefit of co-testing comes from the high-risk HPV screening, then likely the co-testing is really not adding much. If anything, you're adding liquid-based cytology, which is going to give you more false positives, which makes the test worse, because you're going to have more false positives. You're going to have more workup, more colposcopy. You're going to have more of the badness without any of the goodness. So I think that we can say high-risk HPV screening, it's here. It's here to stay. If you want to do co-testing, that's fine, but you're probably not gaining much. In fact, you're gaining some badness with the little gain there. So I digress. On to the next article. The next article is one that personally I actually really don't like that much. It has to do with nutrition, obesity, and exercise. And those are three things that the evidence is terrible for, because people often like to lie. They love to lie about what they eat, how often they eat it, how much they exercise, and when they exercise. It's just human nature. The only problem is that when we can control for what they're eating, let's say we give them food or we give them nutrition, because it is so expensive to pay for people's food, we can only do it for short time frames, in which case we can only then look at surrogate outcomes. Surrogate outcomes are just the death of my existence, the vein of my existence, if you will. We used to think that HDL was so good and protective and that LDL was so bad, and now we know it's probably not the case. Like anything in all of the world, moderation is probably best, and that probably has to do with food and exercise. But I had to include this next article so I could go back to my good friends, Salt and Peppa. Push it real good. Oh yeah, push it real good. This is in JAMA in a paper titled Association Between Push-Up Exercise Capacity and Future Cardiovascular Events Among Active Adult Men. So in this study of just over 1,000 men, they looked to see what was the available evidence or what happened as the amount of push-ups that you could do went down. What happened to your rates of major cardiovascular events? And I think that you can probably guess exactly what happened here. These gentlemen were about 40 years old. On average, they had a BMI of about 28. And when they looked to see how many push-ups you could do, oh, if you could do 40 push-ups or more, basically at 40 years old, you had a pretty good 10-year low-risk rate of cardiovascular events, where if you could only do fewer than 10 push-ups, your rates of cardiovascular events over the next 10 years went up dramatically. Now, I don't think we really need a study to say, listen, if you're 40 years old and you can't do 10 push-ups, you're not looking too good. Your long-term prognosis to not have a heart attack or stroke or some major cardiovascular event is not too good. You are picking up too many cheeseburgers and not pushing up enough of your own body weight in daily exercise and routine. But this just goes ahead and shows it. Now, I can't really see myself using this in practice and saying, well, sir, it looks like you're 40 years old. We're right here in the exam room. How about you get on the ground and give me 10 push-ups? Yeah, that's just not going to happen. So with that being said, this is an interesting article. Doesn't really bring much to the table other than the fact that if you see someone 40 years old, can't do 10 push-ups, you got to know you should spend a couple more holidays with them because their 10-year prognosis, not good to not have a major adverse cardiovascular event. Sometimes I do articles on this podcast that are really for the listener. It's for the listener. I want to get that information out there. But then, oh, there are those articles I read that are for me. They're for me because my own ignorance is shallow. I have such little ignorance. I don't know what I don't even don't know. That's how bad it gets sometimes. And this next article is one of those that I'm just going to briefly touch on, review. And again, if you already know all about this, then don't worry about it. You're already a pro. If you don't know about this, then join me for a little dive, a little discussion of pre-exposure prophylaxis. That's right, PrEP. That is the HIV medication that will help lower the rates of transmission, help decrease the rates of HIV spread. Now, those individuals out there that say, we can't give them PrEP or HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, that's only going to encourage them to have sex. Let me know how that argument is working out for you with birth control. It blows my mind that in the commentary for this paper in the BMJ, there were individuals actually saying that giving people medication encourages them to have risky sexual behavior. I mean, come on, how stupid can we get? Now, this paper, BMJ 2019, titled HIV Pre-Exposure Prophylaxis. Yep, doesn't get any more simpler than that. They do a great job of breaking down the indications, the treatments, and all that. And we're going to go over it real quick. The indications for PrEP is HIV negative male who has condomless anal sex. Unless, and this is key, unless the patient or the person knows their partner, and even if HIV positive has persistently undetectable virus loads. That's right, less than 200 copies for greater than 6 months. One of the things I did not know, that sexual exposure to individuals known to be HIV positive but have persistently undetectable virus loads, less than 200 copies for greater than 6 months, is a zero, yes, basically a zero, negligible, nilch, nothing, risk of acquiring HIV. So if you are a man that has sex with other men and you know that your partner has HIV, but he has no detectable virus loads, you don't need to take PrEP because you can't get the disease as long as your partner doesn't have detectable virus load. To me, that was mind-blowing. I didn't know that. If you're going to give HIV medication, if you're going to give PrEP, then you need to make sure that you screen them for HIV prior to starting medication. Reason being is that PrEP is only two drugs. Treatment for HIV is three drugs. If you're just like with antibiotics, if you're giving only two drugs when the real treatment is three drugs, you could be leading to drug resistance, and that is bad. Oh yes, that is very, very bad. And if the patient sitting in front of you has had exposure within the last 7 to 10 days, then the guidelines recommend repeat testing in 1 to 4 weeks because If the exposure was that recently, the patient may have HIV or may have acquired HIV, but still not pop positive at that time. Now, you can also offer a pregnancy test, but good thing, PrEP is believed to be safe and effective in pregnancy and during breastfeeding, which is pretty awesome. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, that's cool, that's great, but how often is PrEP effective? I mean, is this just a medication that we're giving, but it's, you know, not really effective? I mean, if you're looking for aspirin for secondary prevention, we're talking about a number needed to treat of 1 in 60, which means 59 times out of 60, the individual sitting right there in front of you probably isn't getting benefit from the medication, right? Probably is not going to get benefit from the medication. So how often is PrEP effective? Well, in a paper from 2016 in the Journal of AIDS, it showed that PrEP gave a 70% relative risk reduction in HIV infection compared to placebo. And that was in those individuals with adherence levels of 70% or more. So if you are religious about taking it, it's got a pretty good effectiveness. 70% of the time, it works 70% of the time. But if you were using it less than 40% of the time, if you were taking your PrEP medication, just PRN, kind of whenever you wanted to, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, well, then it doesn't really work much better than placebo. And if we keep going to the Journal of Clinical Infectious Disease from 2015, this was a study based out of San Francisco, just over 800 PrEP starters, and they followed them for 7.2 months, and there were no, zero, zilch new cases of HIV despite high rates of sexually transmitted infections. And you might be saying, well, they were getting STDs, you know, but come on, I mean, were they really having sex? I mean, come on. Well, apparently there were, because again, the STD rate went up, the HIV rate went down, and self-reported use of condoms decreased by 41%. So not only were individuals having just as much sex, if not more than before, they were having increased rates of sexually transmitted infections, but and decreased rates of condom use, and there were zero new cases of HIV. Now, last but not least, we know, just like birth control, the reason that it is not effective is that you don't take it. I mean, even PrEP and birth control, for that matter, if you take it religiously, it's pretty darn effective. In fact, it's not 100%, but it's really good. Well, we know that people just can't take a pill every day. They forget, they leave it on their bedside, their nightstand. They just can't do it for whatever it is worth. So there is an option for those that can't do it. The as-needed or on-demand PrEP. It involves taking 2 tablets, 2 to 24 hours before sex, then a subsequent tablet or treatment 24 hours after sex, and then again 48 hours after sex. If you're going to do this, I think another option, or maybe a more reasonable option, is post-exposure prophylaxis in this situation. But to each their own, and this is an option that some people can deploy if that's what they feel they need to do. PrEP is super effective. We should be talking to our patients about it. We should be giving it out like candy if it's not being given out already, because there could be a day that this medication is so effective that HIV is completely eradicated. That gives me chills. And with that, on to the next article. Speaking of things that give me chills, Big Pharma. Big Pharma and the way that they like to sell drugs. Oh yes, they love to sell drugs. So let's talk about them for just a second. Now, you might wonder, what about expiration dates? Or maybe you've never wondered about them, because until recently, I had never wondered about them. And then I went down the rabbit hole. The rabbit hole that is the expiration dates that are put on medications. I mean, where did these even come from? Because we know for sure, at least I think we can reasonably say, with beyond all reasonable doubt, that it's not that the drug companies have this medication and then they put it into storage and then keep checking on it year after year after year after year until they come up with the exact correct expiration date. No, that would take way too long, and delay the drug getting to the market. So how do we come up with the expiration date? Well, this question came to me after reading a paper in pre-hospital emergency care titled Quality Assessment of Expired Naloxone Products from First Responders Supplies. The big problem is that Food and Drug Administration and pharmaceutical companies, they guarantee the effectiveness of the drug. And this is usually at 2 or 3 years. But at 2 or 3 years, do they really expire? Do they actually stop working? I mean, logically, does it make any sense that at 2 years, 364 days, this medication works, and at 2 years, 366 days, it now doesn't work anymore? I mean, come on, give me a break. Well, in the study, naloxone should only last about 12 to 24 months per the label that is on the medication. But this study collected old expired samples from EMS or law enforcement training supplies with expiration dates ranging from 1990 to 2018. Of the 12 expired samples, only one, that's right, only one that was over 25 years old had less than 90% of active drug. And the shocking thing is that this is a pretty normal finding once I went down the rabbit hole of how often do things actually expire. You see, in 1985, the U.S. Air Force asked the FDA to test some of their quote-unquote expired products. And the FDA said, well, actually, most of your products are still totally workable, so you don't need to replace them all. You can save millions and billions of dollars in not restockpiling your medications. Since then, the FDA has found that 90% of over 100 prescriptions and over-the-counter drugs tested could be used safely past their expiration date. Safely means that it's still 100% effective. You're still going to get the effective dose. When you look at these medications, even when they're 25 years old, I mean, you're still getting 75 to 80% of the effect of the medication. That's a huge effect of the medication. When most of the effect in the drug anyways comes in the first few milligrams, I mean, really, the higher we go in dose, the more we're not actually getting in the dose. The first little bit is most of all of it when it comes to medications. Now, the reason that the expiration date is BS, and this is where I just went down a huge rabbit hole, is that to determine a drug's shelf life, it's just zapped with intense high heat, and then it's soaked with moisture to see how long it degrades under stress, and how long does it take for it to break down. And then the drug company looks at all this and they say, well, I think the expiration date should be about 18 months. But come on, realistically, how often are you leaving your medications with high, intense 500, 600, 700 degree heat? How often are you soaking your medications in water and then letting them just kind of sit and break down? Probably not very often. I personally think that with this information, expiration dates should cease to exist. That's right. I don't think they should exist anymore. We should have kind of like a Budweiser, a born-on date. And then you look at the born-on date, and if it's something really ridiculous like 20 years previously, then maybe you consider not taking that medication. But as long as it's within the last few years, you're probably safe. And realistically, most people, just because they don't know any better, when it's 10 years old or 12 years old, they're not going to use it anyways, even though it's probably go ahead and use, very safe, very effective to use, no problems whatsoever. Whew. Now, I know that we are coming up on the 20-minute mark. It appears there is still time, though, for one more article. This is going to be in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it has to do with the one thing that is the kick in the balls, if you will, for all other things medicine. And that is, of course, smoking. The one thing that ruins everything else in medicine, smoking. The one thing that really, if you want to boil it down, primary care should just be based on the fact of getting everyone off smoking. It would be so much more effective if we're talking numbers needed to treat. Now, this is New England Journal of Medicine, a paper titled A Randomized Trial of E-Cigarettes Versus Nicotine Replacement Therapy. And I know some of you are thinking, oh, this is good. This is real good. Because we don't know what e-cigarettes do. I mean, we all know that people out there use e-cigarettes, but are they using them effectively to quit smoking, or are they just using them to continue smoking in a different form? Well, in this UK study of over 800 patients, almost 900 patients that were smokers, they were randomized to either e-cigarettes or nicotine replacement therapy to determine which one had better abstinence rates at 1 year. That sounds awesome. You're either in the e-cigarette group or the other group. And at 1 year, which one was more likely to have you quit smoking? Well, you were more likely to have a smoke-free life at 1 year in the e-cigarette group. That's right, 18% versus 10% in the nicotine replacement group. However, 80% of the individuals were still using e-cigarettes at 1 year, and only 9% were still using nicotine replacement products at 1 year. So it's good that they weren't smoking cigarettes, but they were still smoking e-cigarettes. And I think that this is a really common thing that we also see in practice. This must force us to ask the question, is how effective are e-cigarettes? Do we really know how effective they are? Now you might be saying to yourself, well, I mean, Andrew, come on. I know that 80% of people were still smoking, but 18% had stopped smoking. 18% is better than no percent. 18% is still a percent. 18% is pretty good, right? Well, you would think, except for when you go to look at the trials on smoking and the medications that we use for smoking cessation, you can go CHEST 2002, Stopping Smoking, a Prospective Randomized Double-Blind Comparing Nortriptyline to Placebo. In this study, as the title says, it was placebo or nortriptyline 25 daily to 75 milligrams daily for 6 weeks. And they said, what is the rate that you stop smoking? It was 20% versus 5.3% in the placebo group. That's a number needed to treat of about 7, which is about the same effectiveness as the e-cigarette. Yes, about the same effectiveness, give or take, you know, a number one or two either way. And I know some of you are saying, wait, nortriptyline, I can't even tell you the last time I wrote for nortriptyline for smoking cessation. Well, that's fair, but I bet you can remember the last time you used bupropion, so let's go to that study, shall we? This was in New England Journal of Medicine back in 1999, a paper titled, A Controlled Trial of Sustained-Release Bupropion, a Nicotine Patch, or Both for Smoking Cessation. In this study, you were randomized to one of four groups. The first group was bupropion, 150 milligrams, a day for 3 days, and then 150 milligrams BID for 60 days, and a placebo patch. In group two, you had a nicotine patch for 6 weeks, followed by a 14 milligram patch for 1 week, and then a 7 milligram patch for 1 week, and a placebo tablet for the entire time. Group three, you got both interventions. You got the patch, 21 milligrams, then 14 milligrams, and then 7 milligrams, and you got the bupropion. And then you're in group four, which just had placebo. Placebo everything. Yeah, group four is the group that kind of got screwed in this trial. Well, the 12-month quit rates were 15.6 in the placebo group and 16.4 in the nicotine patch group. But in the bupropion group, it was 30%. And in the bupropion plus nicotine patch group, 35.5%. That is right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. For those of you calculating at home, the number needed to treat for bupropion compared to placebo is 6.8, or about 7. And for bupropion compared to patch alone, 7.0. And bupropion is the intervention of choice for smoking cessation. Everything in smoking cessation has a number needed to treat of about 10. It's an easy number to remember. Some of them are a little less, some of them are a little more, but it's all about 10. But medications, hands down, should come before e-cigarettes, because we just don't know enough about the e-cigarettes at this time, and they all have about the same number needed to treat. It is definitely better in this situation to dance with the devil you know than the devil you don't know, or at least don't have enough evidence on at this time. With the quick little summary, and then I'll end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before. So here we go, in 20 seconds or less, let's go through a few quick articles, shall we? BMJ, HPV is still the boss of cervical cancer screening. If you want to do co-testing, that's fine, but you're probably not really gaining that much more. In JAMA, push-ups are good. Push it real good, and they are good for health. And if you're 40 years old and you can't do 10 of them, well, then we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. Also in the BMJ, PrEP medication for HIV therapy. Too much to go over. Go back and listen to it. But PrEP definitely works, definitely effective. It should be offered in the clinic, in the office. This could be the first step in eradication of the HIV virus. And expiration dates, 100% made up. They are made up. And if you want my take, they should probably expire from labels. Last but not least, certainly not least, smoking. Yes, smoking. It is the biggest devil, the devil of all details, if you will. It is the risk factor that puts you at all-cause mortality, all-cause cardiovascular mortality, all-cause everything mortality, and all-cause everything medical problems. Smoking, no benefit whatsoever. If you're going to get someone to quit, if they insist on e-cigarettes, that's okay, but it's probably better to dance with the devil you know, and medications still reign king. Now, with that, let me end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Cue the music, and until next time, keep the quest and questioning.